In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us every Friday morning for All Over the Map, which is a quick look at the stories behind local places and things, including old maps and photos like those at the Seattle branch of the National Archives, which now is officially no longer for sale. Congratulations. Yeah.
Well, I had just a tiny part to play, of course. You know, the news came yesterday from the acting director of the White House Office of Management and Budget. They've formally withdrawn their approval from January 2020 that had allowed the sale of that building, which sits on 10 acres near Sandpoint, to proceed. Now, the approval came just a year ago, 10 days after Cairo Radio had brokered the news the facility had been targeted for closure. All of its contents, priceless maps and photos, would be moved to California and Missouri. Now, I thought about this a lot last night. I have just a couple observations about how I think the archives were saved I will now share very quickly. One is that in the wake of the news, a very diverse bipartisan coalition formed around opposing that sale. Republican Secretary of State Kim Wyman, Democrat Attorney General Bob Ferguson, Republican and Democratic senators and representatives from all four states affected. Pretty amazing coalition, plus lots of tribes. Two, Bob Ferguson deserves the most credit for taking action to actually slow down the sale and eventually bring it to a legal halt. I mean, he was suing way back in the summer to get access to documents as part of the legal process. And it was clear that the agencies involved, mostly the OMB, but also this obscure Public Buildings Reform Board, they either had something to hide or they believed they could flout the law. And then three, I think Bob Ferguson gets credit again for recruiting a really diverse group of plaintiffs to join that lawsuit. You know, the city of Seattle, the state of Oregon, and nearly 30 tribes. I think it was Brandon Rainin of the Puyallup tribe who told me that the unity among the tribes around this issue rivaled the unity among tribes around what ultimately became the Bolt decision restoring fishing rights 45 years ago. And it was a staffer in Ferguson's office who noticed back in the fall that the Public Buildings Reform Board was moving to expedite the sale. And then the AG daylighted that and kind of increased the urgency of the lawsuit that was eventually filed and which led to the injunction in February. And that ultimately bought enough time for this new Biden administration, who's very committed to working closely with tribes, to take that official action yesterday and withdraw the approval of the sale. As far as what comes next, this is what the Attorney General told me yesterday.
As great as this victory is today, it's incumbent upon our congressional delegation to find the resources to get the facility in the shape it needs to be in, or find a new facility that can house these records. That is the ultimate victory, but this is a big step along the way.
Yeah, so now it's an opportunity to take that tired old building, which doesn't have a very high public profile. Very few people knew it existed until this came up a year or so ago. Let's make that an actual showplace for federal records and show this how much people in these four states really care about this stuff remaining here, and make it, you know, program it, make it something people can visit and be excited about.
And let's remember, it didn't just come up spontaneously. It came up because you mentioned it.
Well, we had a great Cairo listener who tipped me off about the fact this thing was going to be announced. We broke the news, and then we've just dogged it for the last year or so. But a really amazing coalition of groups and people made this really happen. So it's definitely worth celebrating, but there's a lot of work to do.
This is why we're proud to call you our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, our history activist, our hacktivist. Anyway, have a great weekend, and congratulations.
Thanks, Dave. You too.
Mars. It's the countdown to the first flight of the Ingenuity helicopter, which is planned for Sunday. The drone hitched a ride aboard the Perseverance rover. It's been waiting for its time to shine. And so earlier this morning, I talked with Amy Kwan, mechanical integration engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. The atmosphere on Mars is a tiny fraction of the density of Earth's atmosphere, 1%. So I wanted to know, how do you get a helicopter to stay aloft?
Well, you're correct that the density of the Martian atmosphere is about 1% of the density on Earth. That's about 100,000 feet, if you're looking for an equivalent. But what we did with the helicopter was we made it miniaturized and very, very lightweight. The total weight is about 4 pounds. The rotor span is about 4 feet. And when you spin the rotors very, very fast, multiples of the speed that you would fly a helicopter on Earth, we generate sufficient lift to fly in that thin atmosphere.
And how high can it get off the ground then?
Our first tests are expected to be about 3 meters off the ground.
Yeah. So on board is cameras or do you have other sensors? What else is on the helicopter?
We have two cameras, one to take pictures of our surroundings and one to serve as a navigation camera, because this is actually an autonomously flying helicopter. We don't fly it with a joystick like we would with a, say, radio control car like you would have on Earth. So we give the helicopter a command to go, and it has a preset flight profile that it will follow, and then it flies by itself. So it's going to be looking for landmarks on the ground with that navigation camera.
You can't give it a real-time signal because of the delay in communication.
Correct. Because of how far Mars is from Earth, it can be up to about 15 minutes of a delay between when we send a command on Earth and when you pick it up on Mars.
Okay, so how do you got to recharge it, right? Especially if the thing is the rotor has to rotate that fast. So where does the energy come from?
The energy comes from the sun. We are a solar-powered helicopter. So up until the rover dropped off the helicopter on Mars, we were actually getting electricity from the rover itself, because we were tucked up under the belly of the rover during our flight to Mars. Mm-hmm. And as such, we didn't get any sunlight. But once we were set down on the ground, we were recharging the batteries from the sun.
So the solar panels are on board the helicopter, or does it have to come back to a docking station to get recharged?
The solar panels are right on top of the helicopter, so there is no going back to a docking station.
And there is enough power generated by the onboard solar panels to keep it aloft with the rotors going that fast, huh?
There is. We have a little bit of a limitation. I think our longest flight is about 90 seconds for pretty much that reason. It does take a little bit to recharge between flights. But yes, the solar panel is sufficient to power that 90-second flight.
Well, now there's about a million people saying, when do I get the home version of this? Because that's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. We're all very excited about it and have been since we were working on it.
So there's no consumer version available yet at the Target?
Not exactly like this. We are a coaxial counter-rotating helicopter, which means that both of the blades rotate around a single axis compared to some of the drones you might be familiar with, where they have four propellers, one on each corner. And there are some little toy RC helicopters that are similar in nature to that.
I see. That are powered by solar cells in real time?
Not powered by solar cells.
Well, that's what I mean. That's the cool part.
By solar cells.
You don't have to recharge the thing. Well, then it will still be there when the actual astronauts arrive. And then
quite possibly
they can start using it again.
Awesome. Yes.
just tell me what does it feel like? You're a pretty young person and you're doing this amazing thing. Did you ever think your career would go in this direction?
I wasn't sure. I'm very excited about working on this project, and I have been since I was given the opportunity to do so. I was actually kind of inspired by the Sojourner rover back in 1997, which was also a technology demonstrator itself. That was kind of what paved the way for all the rovers to follow, the Spirit, Opportunity, Curiosity, and now Perseverance. So hopefully we can inspire the next generation as well with this helicopter.
I'll bet you do. And so, and what did you study in school that led you on this path?
I studied mechanical engineering. I liked figuring out how things worked or building things to solve problems.
Well, congratulations and bon voyage for the first flight on Sunday. You're going to be, I assume, glued to the feed from Mars?
Yes. Yes, I will be.
And can anybody watch that? Is there a website to go to?
Yes. We're actually live streaming when the data comes down. That's going to happen at about 12:30 a.m. very early on Monday morning. Mm-hmm. The website to go to if you want to find out all that information is go.nasa.gov/ingenuity.
Excellent. Congratulations, Amy, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Amy Kwan. And she studied engineering, as a lot of people do, and then just sort of sent her application to NASA, and they accepted it. And there you go, instant career, and now she's got an experiment on Mars, for crying
out
loud.
You never know until you try, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if you have any doubts, send the resume to NASA. You never know. Seattle's Morning News. Governor Inslee wants the legislature to do more to address homelessness, and he is bracing the state for potential rollbacks in COVID reopening phases come Monday. Here's Car Radio's Hannah Scott with more. Really? Rollbacks?
Yeah, it's entirely possible. There are those regions in our state right now where things are not looking good. The governor said Actually, I think Pierce County came out yesterday, their own health department, and said that they expect that they will be rolled back come Monday. And I think King and Snohomish counties also at risk. Heard from a reporter yesterday from Spokane who said they might squeak by on Monday when those the day that they actually look at the numbers, but that they expected to be beyond that time, beyond the numbers, beyond the threshold by the end of the next week. So there's a lot of activity going on. And the governor spoke about yesterday that there's these significant concerns about the variant, the variant's activity, specifically the UK variant, its activity in Europe right now. It's a big threat. He said there's still more than 300,000 people over 65 in our state that have not still not been vaccinated. We heard that warning from him the last time.
So what does a rollback mean? What are we talking about? We're not closing down completely again, right?
No. And in fact, he made clear, he made a point to say that that was not going to be the case, that this would be, so we all, the whole state moved to phase three, I think it was 3 weeks ago or so. Now they're going to do the very next check of the numbers. Anyone who's not at the threshold they need to be will just go back to phase two. It will not close any businesses completely. They won't be changing anything that they've, you know, already had as far as phases. It'll just likely mean that capacity will go down from mostly 50% is where most businesses are at right now. It would go back to 25%.
Okay, because I'm looking at the UW chart. There is a definite spike in the numbers of, I'm looking at the confirmed infections now. So we're not talking about conjecture. This is confirmed infections. It's up at the rate of 1,200 a day. And that was back in March. So I can only assume it's gone up since then. How long would this rollback last then? Any clue on that?
Right now, they're going 3 weeks at a time. It's possible that they could, they check the numbers every 3 weeks. It's possible if there's a lot of activity, they may change that. I think prior they had been doing it every 2 weeks, could go back to every 1 week. It just depends on what the activity is that we're seeing from the virus at this point. They said this goes back, the surge we're seeing right now is back to mid-March, and it's just increasing. And again, we're talking about the concern of exponential growth, if you can believe that, the possibility of that happening again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's nowhere near what the peak in December, according to this, was 5,814 cases a day, which was like right around Christmas. So we're nowhere near that. But all right. So I guess we wait to see what the details are. In the meantime, there was some movement on the homelessness issue.
Yes, the governor came out. So right now in the legislative session, both the House and Senate have passed their budgets. They're going into negotiations to come out with one. They both included really significant dollars as far as investments in homelessness. That was part of state dollars and also part of the latest stimulus money. But the governor says there's still this increasing homeless emergency.
We know that services for those experiencing homelessness are critical. And I think this issue merits a new approach from our state government and our legislature, even though this is late in the session. We think that mutual investments and partnerships going forward should focus on strategies getting people off the street and under a roof with dignity and privacy, and that these facilities can have access to services like housing counseling to keep people under a safe roof.
So that's a big kind of, it's not that he hasn't said that before. I've never heard him say just that before. It's very similar to the idea that we heard in the proposed charter amendment for Seattle, right? Finding, not necessarily waiting to build a shelter or anything like that, but buying up maybe hotels, motels, places where they can get people off the street right away. And he wants the legislature to do more than it already is in the budget.
Specifically, I am proposing that the legislature appropriate federal American Rescue Plan dollars toward rapidly acquiring housing units, providing case management, and cleanup and rehabilitation of public spaces that have been used as encampments. This is an additional to the original budget requests I've made, in addition to the significant commitments that have already been made by the legislature.
So he's including cleaning up the encampment. He's saying we want to see a visible difference. Is that what I get from that?
He's saying they want to see a visible difference. And you're hearing this from kind of a lot of different areas. Again, from that proposed charter amendment. There's some talk about this in the legislature. There's one, because there's been this really, really big increase during the pandemic of visible tents and encampments all throughout the parks in Seattle, but not just Seattle. It's a statewide issue. It's everywhere that this is happening right now, and they want to be aggressive. Plus, they have, he said, the two things that happened, this is what he said yesterday. One, we've seen this increase during the pandemic of people living outside and all of the visibility of it, but at the same time, we have these federal dollars. Now, these are one-time federal dollars from the stimulus, but it's enough to at least try to get everybody off the street in kind of one fell swoop. They'll have to figure out where the funding is going to come down the line, though, to keep any programs going if that happens. And he said, here's the hope moving forward.
It is our hope, and I believe legislators' reasonable expectations, that communities that would receive these additional funds that we will be proposing will have effective program strategies and implementation plans that will effectively transition people out of our public parks and right-of-ways and into secure housing.
Secure housing where they're going to have their privacy, the kind of thing that they know works. A housing first model, again, where you're low barrier, that kind of thing.
Well, that is the one lesson of the pandemic, right? When they started putting people in hotels, they actually began making progress and getting their lives back together in a way you can't do when you're living on a in a shelter in a mattress on a mattress on the floor.
Yeah, absolutely.
The question is how expensive is this? Now I'm sure that for hotels they are rates are, have probably never been lower because they're desperate for business. But once the economy picks up, isn't there the prospect that these hotels will want to kick the low paying homeless people out and get back to market rate room rentals?
And I think two things. One, he did not put a dollar amount on this yesterday. He just said, lawmakers, I want you to put more of the stimulus money in. Let's do this, come up with a plan. And then he said also that the hope was that this would go for communities where there's a significant problem, but where they also have kind of a strategy. They're already working on this. And I think in some cases there's been not that they're just renting rooms for people from these hotels, but I think there's been purchases of hotels. So I don't know the details. He didn't say it would be, I think, up to the jurisdictions that get some of this money, how they want to do it in their own backyard. But, there's a clock on the stimulus dollars that they can use, just like there was with the CARES Act. So they have so long that they can use it. Why not use it for this at this point?
Mm-hmm. Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
The Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. Take musicians in search of an audience and some nervous people in need of entertainment. Put them together, and this is what you get.
For most of us, life's milestones are marked by a soundtrack. That's why performances are popping up at vaccination sites across the country. And whether it's Yo-Yo Ma in Massachusetts or Richmond Philharmonic players in Virginia, it seems clear there's medicine in music.
It was actually really great to come out of a really tense, environment and hear the music. When I sat down, they were playing God Only Knows Where I'd Be Without You, the Beach Boys. So it was a nice feeling.
In New York City, the Jacob Javits Convention Center's sprawling campus has transformed into the country's largest vaccination site, vaccinating 14,000 people daily. Javits CEO Alan Steele.
I mean, this represents freedom. They don't lose their mask, but what they do is they lose some of their inhibitions about the future.
And while there's understandable anxiety,
in the beginning, I was like nervous, a little bit.
The music offers a relaxing remedy for patients.
We've noticed that there's a direct correlation between decreased levels of anxiety and calming people's nerves when the music is present.
And a place for artists to finally perform.
I have artists every day looking at me and saying, you have brought me back my first gig for the last year.
Sing for Hope was created after 9/11. Camille Zamora and her co-founder were students at Juilliard at the time. And just like now, with the pandemic, everything came to a halt, and they wanted to do something to bring joy. So they gathered some musicians and performed for first responders. The rest is history.
How you doing, Dave? I saw you
jogging circles. I think I'm doing okay.
I missed getting video of it, so I can't put it on Twitter, darn it. But that is Vladimir Dutier reporting, by the way. Lovely to hear that music.
It is indeed. And now from the Gene Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here's G. Scott. Are you in the mood to talk about scandalous politicians? I don't know what to make about it because he denies everything and I have no independent information. So what do you get from the Matt Gaetz case?
You mean the same guy that tried to go and cancel Liz Cheney, Matt Gaetz?
Yeah.
I think it's sick. I think that the truth is going to never expire, which it never does. And it seems like one of his buddies is going to tell on him here pretty soon. There is no honor amongst thieves, Dave and Colleen. So then there's that. And it's just interesting, right? Like, it seems like the same people that was putting all those funny memes and jokes and making fun of President Joe Biden, they're for some reason silent about Matt Gaetz. Why that is, I don't know. But it's really unfortunate, right?
No, it's not just Matt Gaetz, though. It's Andrew Cuomo. More and more people are coming forward with very specific stories about, his wandering hands.
About Cuomo?
Yeah.
But we talked about that. Yeah. At length, right? Like, when it comes to Cuomo. And by the way, he needs to step down. I think one of the biggest problems, and maybe you can talk about this, and this is probably something new for you, considering you've been in news for so long. This new just deniability and this, no, I'm not stepping down. What happened? There used to be a back in it. Even President Nixon resigned. Why won't these folks step down?
Now, it took him a while, but I mean, there was the Gary Hart case. There was the Wilbur Mills case, which I know most people have forgotten.
I remember Gary Hart's
scandals.
Case.
I mean, Alexander Hamilton, gee, right? Alexander Hamilton, right?
He was Clinton denied it as well. Still got caught. And,
I mean, I did not. Okay, go ahead.
Have sex with that? Yeah. The Me Too movement has been going on for so long now, and I'm grateful for it because it is catching men in this behavior, and it's causing other men to rethink their behavior. That's my hope anyway. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just tired. You know what I mean? Like, I thought, what am I going to say about this Matthew Gaetz situation and Andrew Cuomo that I haven't already said or lived or experienced or heard women in my life talk about? I'm just wondering, as, you know, a group of guys here, we've got G, we've got Sully, we've got Dave. Is it, I don't know. Do you reflect on it and go, like, what is wrong with my gender? Or I don't know. Like,
yeah,
what's the impact
the
on
time.
You?
I mean, I talked to my wife about what she faced, and I find it embarrassing. I don't know what else to say about it. I frankly was never comfortable in the boys' locker room because of all the stuff that went on in there, but I don't know what to do about it.
I want to say this. When you start saying, like, I do question those. I do ask that, like, what's wrong with our gender? But then I also am reminded, like, well, hold on, because black men, no problem. We have for sure gone down for these things, and it's very hard for any of us to get away with any of this stuff in the workplace. And I'm specifically talking about black men in corporate America, considering there's not that many of us in corporate America. So yes, Colleen, there has been a power problem in this country. There has been a money problem.
Not to mention black men too, historically falsely accused of rape and being predators of white women too. So
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So you have that as well. So this is all, and I agree with you, Colleen. What more can be said about this other than here we go again? I just hope that there isn't a partisan opinion on these topics. Don't make your opinion based on what side of politics that they're on. It should be straight up. So for an example, when Andrew Cuomo and that came out, we talked about it on our show right away. And by the way, he for sure needs to step down. No question about it. And anybody else that is in that situation that puts women in that dynamic is sickening, and it's just terrible.
Did you hear him joke about it, too, at a press conference the other day with a male reporter saying he had a cute little button nose? I mean, just the audacity to
be... This is Cuomo?
Cuomo, yeah, facing multiple sexual abuse, assault allegations, and then to make a tongue-in-cheek comment about the appearance of a male reporter, to me, just sort of brings vomit into my throat. And then reading about, was it BuzzFeed or Daily Beast? Somebody got the Venmo... from a source of Matthew Gaetz,
yeah,
where
Daily Beast.
it shows him transferring $900 to this accused child trafficker, and then that accused child trafficker gave it to three women, one of them who was 17 at the time of the transaction. And it just made me want to vomit, because we have these grown men who, you know, are up on these soap boxes talking about America first and President Trump is a man and he needs to lead the country. Meantime, you're raping 17-year-olds, allegedly, you know, like... I get so upset about it, raising young girls, and it's just, I want swift justice for these situations. And in politics, that's not happening.
Well, there's a Venmo record, apparently, Colleen, from what I read in that Daily Beast article.
Which, that was what I wanted to
And they
to
wrote
talk.
For school.
This is what I wanted to talk to you two about. First, I have a confession. And then after my confession, I'm going to ask you. I ain't going to lie, guys. Often, I get on Venmo and scroll. I scroll and I'm nosy. And I like to find out what other people are doing and who's paying who. Have you guys ever done that before? Got on Venmo? Dave Ross, you don't seem like you've done that. Colleen, I know you've done it.
I've seen it before. I keep most of my transactions private. You know,
no, your transactions. How about other people's transactions?
I see them and I go, oh, okay. You know, it's a very ho-hum. I don't have a very interesting life or pool of friends. So
I mean,
it's not like my friends are like, you know, hobnobbing with celebrities or anything. So I don't know what's going on.
You don't see like, oh, rent payment for the month or groceries or that slice of pizza or gambling debt.
Boy, there is
okay,
no
it's just
way.
Me. It's
I
just
would
me.
Go public with that. I'm sure this will all be discussed
Dave,
very energetically.
We don't get personal on the Gene Ursula Show. No. We stick just to news, Dave.
That's right. I understand that completely. Starting at 9, right here in Congress.
Tyler Lockett will be on the show today.
And that too.
Yeah.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Joe Biden has said absolutely no vaccine passports in the United States of America, at least from the federal government, but New York is trying it. And Jeffrey Fowler, who is a technology columnist for the Washington Post, got himself one of New York's vaccine passports. How'd that work out for you?
Well, it's a mixed bag, but it's definitely worth investigating because a lot more states and even businesses and other countries as well are all trying to figure out whether they should and how they should go about making these digital vaccine passports.
So how does it work? This is on your smartphone, right?
That's right. So New York's vaccine passport is called the Excelsior Pass, and it works – it's a kind of a combination of a state website and then also some apps that work on phones. So you can use this website to pull up your passport. You could even print it out if you want. And you can move it onto your phone. And then when you go to a business, they can use an app also made by the state of New York to scan it to decide whether to let you into the business.
So this gives you – this displays like a boarding pass for an airplane that can be scanned and shows whether you're legit or not?
Yeah. It's a lot like a boarding pass for an airplane. It gives a check mark. Then the check mark means you have either gotten your full vaccination – at least 14 days ago, and or it means that you have gotten a negative COVID test very recently.
So this the data then has to come what directly from the pharmacy where you or the clinic where you got the test? Is that what they do?
So it turns out in the state of New York that and many other states that there's already an official database that includes every single person who's gotten the vaccine and also every single person who's gotten a COVID test. Where we hit some snags in testing out this app is that not all testing providers are quite as good about updating the state on their records. So, for example, Yankee Stadium is open now, and you can get in if you bring a vaccine passport and you prove that you've either gotten the vaccine or gotten your test. So a colleague of mine got one of those rapid tests that you know gives you the result within 30 minutes. He took it. He went to Yankee Stadium, and then he pulled up the vaccine passport app. It didn't have his test results yet. And the state says, oh, yeah, by the way, not everybody's really sort of fully participating yet. So that's some of that one example of the kinds of problems they got to work out to make these things really accessible to everyone.
I saw in your piece that the database was updated after the game was over and he finally got the green check mark.
That's right. But the good news is, at least in the design of New York's system, he was still able to get into the game because they still accept pieces of paper. So those little CDC cards that you have to prove your vaccination, or just a printout of your vaccination, of your test result.
So it's typical garbage in, garbage out. If they don't maintain the database properly, then the vaccine passport doesn't work. But it sounds like if at least they enter the data correctly, it's a good thing. Or does it creep you out to know that all this data is on file somewhere?
Well, look, the data is on file no matter what, right? The state will have access to it. One of the problems, though, beyond just sort of the database is not being necessarily up to snuff, another problem that we found is actually it's really easy to fake. So I know a privacy advocate in New York, and you know, lots of people are posting their vaccine selfies, right, with their CDC card to tell their friends, I got my vaccine. Problem is, when you do that, you're actually putting some valuable information out there, some private information. And so all he had to do, this privacy advocate, was go pull up some people's social media accounts and then type in the information from that into the Excelsior Pass website, and he was able to steal other people's vaccine passports.
Now, wait a second. A sharp database, though, would catch that it was going to two different devices, wouldn't it?
Not the way this one was designed, I'm afraid.
Uh-oh.
They it's not, you know, we sort of have now gotten accustomed to the way that phones can be used to do things securely, like Apple Pay or Google Pay, right? Which is how a lot of people now pay for things, you know, with credit cards on their phone. But this system didn't build any of those kinds of security protections. It does, you know, the first time you get your Excelsior Pass code, a QR code, that little scanner code, it does ask you some challenge questions. But those challenge questions are all things about where and how you got vaccinated, which, again, people are putting on the internet to brag about. And so, you know, there's kind of a problem there. Now, there is a good question we don't know the answer to, which is like, well, how dangerous is it if people fake their vaccine credentials?
Yeah.
We don't know. We don't have any information about that. But it certainly seems like they could have built more security into the system.
Well, it should send up a red flag in the database when suddenly 4 million people got all their shots at the same time in the same place, right?
Well, you would think so. But one of the things that they had designed into the system that I actually do like is it's actually pretty good about privacy. So it's pretty decentralized. So, you know, after that initial check happens to pull over someone's vaccine credential, it doesn't actually check back in with the state of New York system. It uses a separate thing. The idea was that they didn't want the state of New York to be able to track
where you go,
where you used it, right? Yeah. Didn't need to get a record every time you went to Yankee Stadium or Madison Square Garden, or as these things become more popular, maybe the grocery store or work. So I like that aspect of it. I think they actually got some of it right, but not all of it.
Yeah, but if everybody can fake legitimacy, then it pretty much defeats the whole idea of this thing. Do you think it's going to catch on? Do you think that this is – would you be subject to a lawsuit, for example, or for being negligent if you suddenly allowed a bunch of unvaccinated people into a closed area?
That's a really good question. I think the conversation that we need to have, and unfortunately, the state of New York hasn't really been a leader on this either. The conversation is, where does proving people's vaccination or test credentials, where does that actually make us safer? Mm-hmm. And where does it just sort of add unnecessary bureaucracy and hurdles to everyday life? It could turn out to be that actually it does keep people safer in places where you're going to sit in the same chair, like at a basketball game for 2 hours, but it's completely unnecessary at the grocery store or, you know, at Starbucks. We just don't know the answer to that yet. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to have to figure out. It's also a very different thing to ask for people to prove their vaccine credentials when they're traveling internationally. You know, we're already accustomed to showing a passport when we want to go to another country. So this could become part of it. That's very different from asking it at a business, right? Because in America, we haven't typically done that. We haven't typically required ID checks just to do everyday life things. And then also, remember, we've got all these variants of the virus out there, and they could flare up in unexpected ways. So there's just a lot with the science that we still don't know.
Jeffrey Fowler, tech columnist for The Washington Post. Travel safe.
You too.
Look at this. A little relief for people living in West Seattle. How often have we been able to say that in the last year? The Lower Spokane Street Bridge is going to be opened up on a limited basis, and Chris tells us who gets the pass.
All right, well, we're there in the process of figuring that part out, but the city currently allows about 450 trips across the low bridge for port employees, a small number of businesses making emergency store runs, and some other select groups. But the city is now going to double that to 900 trips a day, and it is about to launch an online application process. So how can they do this and keep the bridge free for emergency vehicles, transit, and freight? Trips on the bridge are down 38% since photo enforcement went active in January, and Terminal 5, which is opening up there on Harbor Island, delayed its opening until 2022. So City Mobility Director Heather Marks says that's left the bridge with some capacity. All restaurants and retail businesses in West Seattle will be able to apply for monthly access.
Each business will have 10 round trips that they are allowed to take in any given month. They can submit as many as 3 license plates to take those trips.
But Marks was quite clear when I talked to her yesterday. These are for unplanned emergency supply trips. Like if your pizza restaurant didn't get its cheese delivery and an employee needs to run to Costco.
If we observe through the data and through the license plate collection that folks are seem to be abusing it, for example, if we start to note commute-like behavior, crossing the bridge at the same time every morning, coming back the same time every afternoon, we'll definitely be in touch with those folks.
On-call medical staff will also be able to apply for access to the bridge so they can get it over to their places of business much faster. So will people receiving life-saving medical care, like chemotherapy.
We are going to use the same process that we use for disabled parking permits. And so there's a part of that that the patient would fill out, and then their healthcare provider would have to fill out the rest.
The medical care application should be online later today. The common application for the rest should be online by the end of the month. But Marks also wants to be very clear that this extra access could and quite likely will go away before the high bridge is repaired and open next year. One, if people abuse the system, like we heard. Other, if the trips start exceeding that daily capacity. And most likely, when T5 opens early next year, and the freight trips go up significantly, taking away that extra capacity.
Once we get to that point with the Northwest Seaport Alliance and the Port of Seattle, where Terminal 5 is open all the time and operating fully, there are going to be so many freight trips on that low bridge that we may have to entirely revoke those conditional trips.
So get it while you can. Anybody who's been in the system to use the low bridge now must also reapply. Those granted access will have their license plates entered into a system, and they should not receive a photo ticket when using the bridge. If they do, they can go back and reconcile and say, listen, I was on the okay list, and they'll waive it. Other good news for West Seattle drivers today, you're going to get a few more weekend hours to use that low bridge starting tomorrow. And I'm talking everybody using that low bridge. Current restricted hours 7 days a week are from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m., but starting tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday restricted hours are going to move from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m., so you get a couple extra hours in the morning to get around and use that low bridge without a penalty.
So they have cameras snapping license plate pictures.
Oh, yeah, they do, and they're still getting hundreds of violations a day on that, but it's come down significantly, 38% since the cameras went in.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.